get started so we can get everybody home safely tonight. Our next speaker is Andrew Curley. He's a graduate student in sociology at Cornell University, and he'll be presenting a paper titled Natural Resource Development and New Forms of Colonialism on American Indian Reservations.
Hello, are there any other Navajo folks in the audience? Well, I guess not, but my name is Andrew Curley, and I would give you a formal introduction if there are Navajos, but this doesn't make sense because nobody is related to me by clan in that respect. So, two corrections. First, I'm a graduate student in department called Development Sociology. It's separate from regular sociology at Cornell. And regular sociology would probably make that correction if I hadn't, so I thought I would do that. The second correction is that it's not actually a paper, but just kind of a presentation. Most of the information that I'm presenting comes from my work experience on the Navajo Nation at a tribal college. Working at a policy institute there. I was working at what's called the Diné Policy Institute at Diné College in Sierra Leone, Arizona. And a lot of the information here, a lot of the perspectives come from that work and some of the research. So I took from different papers to kind of give a broader assessment of natural resource development on the Navajo Nation. And then, just a forewarning, I'm also going to read a lot from some academic books. As boring as it can be, these people do a much better job at presenting the information, especially when it comes to American Indian reservations more generally. And so I thought it would be, rather than try to go through it and summarize and reword and make it more awkward than it has to be, I'll present it the way they wrote it so that it's clearer for everyone else. Another reason for doing this is that my work comes specifically from working on the Navajo Nation, and in order to get it and to situate it within the greater U.S. Reservation system, I would need to draw on these other pieces of work. So I hope you will accept that as I go forward through the presentation. So, first I want to begin by saying that I'm going to try to relate this all to colonialism, and that's the title of the talk, and I think the previous speakers have really situated the colonial argument well, demonstrated how, for example, Columbus came in and created all sorts of atrocities against the people in the Caribbean, and you know, Columbus's descendants came in. Did just as bad things and worse, possibly, in other parts of the country. So I'm going to try to address that narrative and situate the Navajo Nation and situate resource extraction and also social movement responses to resource extraction. So there's going to be a lot of stuff going on. And I'm going to try to tie it together. If it doesn't make sense, then you can ask me questions, and I'll clarify it. So, it's a complex issue, and I'm trying to work it together as best as possible. So first, I'm going to start off with great president of the Navajo Nation, Joe Shirley Jr. This kind of gives you an introduction flavor of what's going on. Joe Shirley Jr. has been president of the Navajo Nation tribal government since 2002. He was quoted September 30th. This isn't really a quote, it's a press release, but the people who put the press release together for him put it as a quote, so I treat it as a quote. He says that unlike ever before, environmental activists and organizations are among the greatest threat to tribal sovereignty. Now this is a loaded quote, there's a lot of things that are referenced, this idea of sovereignty. With tribal governments is in direct reference to changes in American Indian federal policy towards American Indians. which I can go through, but I don't really treat it in this presentation. So just know that since the 1970s, there's been something called a nation-to-nation approach to working with Indian reservations, and as a result, there's been efforts from people like Joe Shirley to emphasize sovereignty. Sovereignty for Indian people means something slightly different than what we get from standard political science texts. So just for that disclaimer. But nevertheless, this is a popular statement that you hear on American Indian reservations, and Joe Shirley's using it in this quote. Also, he's referencing environmental organizations who are opposed to resource extraction, principally. And this is how he sets up the dichotomy. There's environmental organizations out there, and they're opposed to these types of extractive development activities on tribal land, and therefore they are against sovereignty, and they're against the interest of the Indian people, American Indian people. And so we're gonna kind of tease that out and see if that's really the case. But it's just good to know that this is the perspective of tribal governments currently. On the flip side of that, the environmental organizations that Joe Shirley talks about have been working for years and especially hard this last year to pass a economic development plan that would emphasize green job development on the Navajo Nation in particular. Different environmental organizations, Black Mesa Water Coalition, Sierra Club, some Indigenous Environmental Network, they came together and kind of created this largely confederation of these organizations to under this umbrella group called the Navajo Green Jobs Coalition. And this worked with the Navajo Nation Council to pass two pieces of legislation this summer that establishes a commission and a fund to bring green jobs to the Navajo Nation. It ties in with federal climate change legislation that's going before the Congress right now, trying to get some of the stimulus money as well. This is previous legislation, and emphasize green job development on the Navajo Nation. And so this is on the other end of the spectrum. These are the organizations that Joe Shirley references when he's talking about threats to tribal sovereignty. I'm just going to read a quote from one of the organizers for the Black Mesa Water Coalition, also the Navajo Green Job Campaign. And just for disclaimer, I've actually worked with this woman before at the Diné Policy Institute, where I was before starting my graduate program. She says, "We want green jobs for Navajo youth. Right now, unemployment on the reservation is about 44%. There's nothing for young people. The only ones working are college graduates. There are no jobs. That's why I'm pushing for the Green Jobs Act, because of two reasons. A, these jobs aren't coal mining, and B, they're safe for the Mother Earth. I'm pushing for this, more job creation and development." So as you can hear, this is what Nikki Alex is, a woman who says this. Sorry, I didn't give the proper citation. So this is what I'm talking about when I'm saying new forms of colonialism, not green jobs, but the idea of resource extraction, development, modernity, all of these things that are challenging American Indian people on reservations, off reservations right now. And I'm going to try to give you kind of an understanding of the current situation. But now we're going to have to go back to kind of a discourse on colonialism. Big term that we're using, but let me try to give it some some definition. Colonialism, according to Blunner, who wrote in 1969 a report on internal colonialism and ghetto revolts. I forgot his first name, I think it's Richard. And this is cited by American Indian political scientist, I think, and historian, David Wilkins. I mean, he just does a lot of stuff on American Indian political systems. And anyway, so he wrote that, Blunner wrote that colonialism, as a concept, conceptually speaking, colonialism traditionally refers to the establishment of domination over a geographically external political unit, most often inhabited by people of a different race and culture, where this domination is political and economic, and the colony exists subordinate to and dependent upon the mother country. That's Blunner's definition of colonialism, and I'm going to try to show that this is a situation facing American Indian reservations today. Not all reservations are the same. This definition of colonialism and the way I treat it is really, really specified towards, or is directed towards reservations that produce minerals that are exported and sold and or burned and produced and help to give energy to cities, which I'll get into more detail in just a moment. So let's take a look at this process of colonialism, which I just laid out. This is a popular map of the waning of American Indian territory in the U.S. as the U.S. is politically defined today. So, 1492, when our man Columbus comes along, this is American Indian territory. Then 1790, as you can tell, there's an expansion from colonialists, mainly of British descent, over in this area of the country in New England and the Northeast, and this is when they have the Northwest Ordinance Act of 1787, and it pushes more land out. And at this point, people are moving westward, appropriating land and removing Indians. So as you can see, I have these markers here. What type of activity is happening? You have displacement when mercantile Europe encounters North America and North Americans, indigenous people, there's displacement. There's displacement during when agrarian British colonialists pushed westward, this during the late 18th century. And then there continues to be displacement up until between the 1830s and 1880s when the reservation system comes into formation. And incidentally, the US economy starts shifting from agrarian to industrial in scope. And so then you get to our current situation where 1890, these are the reservation boundaries. This map is in fact inaccurate. The Navajo Nation, which is this little portion right here in Arizona, I should have told you where it all was actually. Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. This reservation didn't exist like it does then. In fact, the Navajo Nation is the only reservation I've been told to increase in size since a treaty was formally agreed upon between the United States and the Navajo people at that time. And so this was much smaller, and I'm sure things were different with other reservations as well. Another important thing to know is that, in fact, this wasn't by 1830, 1790, that wasn't all Indian territory. The Spanish were creeping up along the Rio Grande towards Arizona, New Mexico, and California. But this map doesn't reflect that, unfortunately. Navajo people, whom I'm going to focus on, these are the Europeans that have the longest history, historical interaction with Navajo people. So it's unfortunate that this map doesn't reflect that. It's just as well that we go on the sleep mode for a second, because I'm going to read some excerpts from different authors on this topic. The first is by a woman named Clara Kelly. Who writes, just to kind of summarize her argument, by the way, this is found in a really good book. This is University of New Mexico in the 1980s started producing a series of booklets on American Indian economic development, And this is one of two that I've been able to find, and you have a lot of good articles in here, including this one. But anyway, this one comes from a book titled Economic Development in the American Indian Reservations. This is the first year it was put on a woman named Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, when she was the head of the Native American Studies program at UNM at this time, and she started this series, and this was published in 1979, and she got a lot of people to come and collaborate, including, you know, Native American poets like Simon Ortiz. He has an entry in the beginning that gives a poem that kind of focuses on, I don't know, I haven't read the poem to be honest, but I'm sure it has something to do with development. But anyway, so what Clara Kelly writes, federal Indian land policy has evolved alongside the American economic system in the United States. Until the Civil War, the availability of relatively uncolonized territory maintained the dominance of small-scale agricultural production in merchant capital. Indian lands provided profits to land speculators, some farmers, and merchants. As the supply of uncolonized territory decreased, small farms were no longer viable, and industrial capital grew at the expense of merchant capital. During this transition period, which lasted until 1920, Indian lands served the interests of both groups. Furthermore, expropriation of Indian lands together with the dispossession of public lands became an economic stabilizer in bust periods long before the federal government adopted Keynesian policies, boom and bust, officially. After 1920, the dominance of industrial capital in the United States economy was established. Indian lands continued to supply profits through cheap raw materials and the dominant capitalist interests. But in addition, began to subsidize a rural industrial reserve army during bus. In this way, they have continued their stabilizing function, but by subsidizing unemployed Indians rather than ruin non-Indian farmers. So that kind of articulates what I was talking about within this transition period between 1790, oh shoot, I don't know why. This is a problem when you use a Mac, I guess. I think it's slow because I've been like doing too much.
Oh, the projector turned off.
Oh, the projector went. I'm asleep.
Turn
it
down just a second.
When it's not active.
So that's Clara Kelly. And then I'm going to read an excerpt from C. Matt Snip, who also was writing about this same issue. Am I going to read it? No, actually, I decided not to use C. Matt Snip here. But I will read. I'll read his in just a moment as this comes back on. So when the projector comes back on, you're going to see a map of North and South America. There it is. When I was saying that, going back, that the United States, this map of a waning reservation or Indian territory isn't accurate because of the fact that it didn't include the Spanish and other colonists at the time. I decided I'd find a colonial map that I think was better, and this is what I found. So you can see that up along Mexico and into what's modern day Utah, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, California, Nevada, that this was called New Spain, and the Spanish had a presence in this area. They didn't have complete control over it, as this map might indicate, particularly when you're in Arizona and New Mexico. The Spanish colonists were based largely along the Rio Grande River, and their headquarters was in Santa Fe, which was far from Navajo territory. And Navajos lived, Navajos, Apaches, and some other peoples in the area, they lived pretty much autonomously, an autonomous life. I don't know how to phrase that. Whereas the Pueblos along the Rio Grande were completely dominated by the Spanish. So you had different experiences from, depending on which tribe you're talking about. But anyway, so that was just a correction of the map. So now I'm going to start talking about mineral extraction, mineral development on American Indian reservations. And in order to introduce this topic, I thought I would show you all some maps. This is the current this is a current map of American Indian reservations in the United States. The Navajo Nation is kind of this grayish thing right here. And right in the middle, that is where the Hopi tribe is located. I say Hopi tribe instead of nation because that's the official name of the area. The Hopi tribal government calls itself the Hopi tribe, so I use their own terminology. Anyway, so you see all of these reservations, a lot of the big area reservations are on the western part of the United States, where you happen to find a lot of mineral reserves. And I'm going to try, it was really difficult, but I tried to put some overlay of mineral maps of different minerals that are important for extraction and exploitation, to use those proper words, but for the U.S. energy economy, and how they might overlay reservation land. But first, let me show you what the maps are that I have. This is the oil and natural gas production in the United States. As you can see, there's going to be a bunch of red over in the Appalachia area, and this place is really exploited for mineral wealth, and even though that's catch everybody's eye first, we're going to focus on the western side of the country. But anyway, this is where oil, gas, and I guess mixed oil and gas wells are found currently. And as you can see here, this is, I'm going to focus on Navajo Nation, so I'll go ahead and start pointing it out. You know, up in near this is San Juan River, up around this area, there's a lot of oil and gas wells. And that's Navajo and Ute territory. This is coal, a map of the coal reserves on the in the U.S. You can see, again, Appalachia has a lot of it. But along the near the Rocky Mountain area, up in Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona, there's patches, big blocks there. An important thing to realize about the coal, there's a difference in the type of coal you have on the west and in the east. This blackish coal has a lot of sulfur in it, and it's a dirtier coal when it burns. And so as energy policy shifts towards using so-called clean coal technologies, this is going to be more prized, and it happens to be a lot of it on reservation land. Wyoming right now is probably the largest producer of coal, but we're going to look at Arizona, which ranks pretty high up there as well. This is uranium reserves. Now we're in our new, in our era of global warming and climate change, uranium is actually seen as an alternative to coal for nuclear energy. Which is problematic, but you know, that's the reality of it. The people are really in 2007 the price of uranium increased from like $12 per ton to like 100 and something. I don't know. These are just arbitrary figures, but it was a dramatic increase in uranium prices. And there's a lot of pressure on the Navajo Nation to, revoke its ban on uranium mining, in order to cash in on some of this. And I'll talk about the ban in a moment, but just to let you know, that's those are the politics that develop around these mineral reserves. So that's uranium. Okay, so now I'm gonna try to show you the overlays, I think. Yeah, so here's Indian reservations again. And this is the western sector of coal. So you can see, like, especially on the Navajo Nation, how it overlaps on Navajo and Hopi territory. 135 billion tons are in the western sector. That's more than on the central or eastern sector. And so this is where coal is found in the US. And as we have a, we enter into a political climate of moving away from what's called foreign oil, these are going to be the obvious candidates to replace that. So this is the Navajo Nation again right here. This is the Hopi Reservation boundaries. You can see there's a lot of coal right here that is primarily on Navajo land, but also found. There is also some of it found on the Hopi land too, which has created problems between Hopis and Navajos. And then up on the Wyoming and the Sioux reservations and those. And Montana and South Dakota, you can see that as well. And there are political issues happening in these areas. The Crow Reservation, I was told, has a lot of coal reserves, and there's been moves to take advantage of that for them, as I see it, taking advantage of it. But that's a different story. Anyway, so this is again the reservation map and an overlay with the oil and natural gas. And you can see it's not an exact, I mean, I worked with this a lot yesterday and today trying to fix it, but I have limited technological expertise, or technical expertise. Anyway, so this is the oil, natural gas. It is kind of accurate from my knowledge of the area. There is a lot of oil, natural gas here Southern Utah and New Mexico on reservation land. And then again, the reservation map with the uranium map. It's not perfect, but this part is important. The Grants Mineral Belt, as it's called here. If you know anything about the Navajo history, there was a lot of there's a legacy of uranium exploitation on the eastern part of the reservation in this area, which is near where the current Grants Mineral Belt is. And in fact, there's a lot of contention happening right now in Grants, New Mexico, between different people, the Navajo, the Acoma, Pueblo, I think the Laguna, and old Hispanic families who have land there. They want to. It's a lot like up here in, I guess, the Catskill area, where there's natural gas, and they're going to different people and they're like saying, we'll give you money, you give us your gas. It's the same type of thing with in New Mexico with uranium happening right now. There was a uranium conference not too long ago, in fact, that was addressing this issue. So let me catch up on my own slides here. So that's the U.S. and that's the situation for American Indian reservations in terms of mineral development. So let's start to focus in on the Navajo situation. This is Dene Bekea. That's a Navajo term for Navajo land. Essentially, is what it means. And this is a map of the reservation. Where most of the coal is located, there's four coal mines right now, and a lot of the contention is around coal found in this area near Kayenta, Arizona. There's a Black Mesa, where Black Mesa Mine is, and Kayenta Mine right nearby. Navajo Mine, which is located a little bit east of that, is closer towards Farmington, New Mexico, and Shiprock, New Mexico, or it's on the Navajo Nation, but it's in on the New Mexico side of the Navajo Nation. And then there's McKinley Mine, which is between Gallup and Window Rock, Arizona. Here's Gallup, here's Window Rock, and so right around here is McKinley Mine. And this mine is going to close down soon. It's running out of reserves, doesn't produce a lot of coal, and they're already laying off a lot of mine workers right now. So anyway, that's the map. This is a map of the Navajo reservation, Navajo reservation boundary. So it's a political map. It's not where all the Navajos live, but this is the territory over which the Navajo government has control. So let's talk about the coal mine. I'm going to focus in on coal mines. I should have said that. Sorry, I forgot to announce what I'm going to do. I'm going to focus in on coal development on the Navajo Nation, and not talk about gas, uranium, or oil. Because coal is important environmentally speaking, and it relates to a lot of these social movements I'm talking about. Though I can talk more about uranium and these other things if you want. Anyway, so there's four mines, coal mines on the Navajo Nation. Black Mesa Mine, Kayenta Mine, McKinley Mine, Navajo Mine, all of these I just mentioned. And in order to show how this is getting back to our colonialism hypothesis, that I put the ownership of each mine next to the name of the mine. So Black Mesa and Kayenta Mine are owned by Peabody Western Coal Company, which I believe is based in St. Louis, Missouri. McKinley Mine used to be owned by Pittsburgh something or other, but now it's owned by Chevron, which has been owned by Chevron for a few years now. And Navajo Mine is owned by BHP, a transnational mineral company based in Australia. I listed the ranks nationally. Kayenta Mine and Navajo Mine rank 18 and 19 in terms of the amount of coal they produce. So nationally, with all the coal produced in the country, these two mines are 18 and 19 on the list. Navajo Mine produces 9 million tons, and Kayenta Mine produces 8 million tons. So just to give you an idea of what's going on in terms of resource extraction on American Indian reservations. So here's a little, this brief history of coal mining on the Navajo Nation. Before 1900, there was limited coal mining by independent entrepreneurs or something along those lines. There's a woman named Colleen O'Neill who writes about this, the Navajo working, I forget the name of the book, but anyway, working labor in Navajos or something like that. But anyway, she characterizes these Navajo people, men primarily, who went out and dug up coal and sold it to BIA or offices or trading posts at that time. And she called them independent entrepreneurs. Whether or not that's an appropriate characterization of what they were doing and how they and why they were doing it, I think is something that's debatable. But anyway, that's what she writes. The point is that these were small-scale activities. They weren't industrial in nature. People would go out, and coal was located close to the surface. It wouldn't take a lot of mining to dig it up. It doesn't take blowing up a mountain like it does in West Virginia now to do that. So it was an easy thing for them to do. Between 1930s and 1960s, BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, I don't know, I'm assuming everybody knows who the Bureau of Indian Affairs is, but if you don't, I'd probably be good to go over it now. Does everybody know who the BIA is? Or does it? Yeah. Okay, anyway, so the BIA, under the Department of Interior, who oversees Indian reservations with trustee relationship, between the 30s and 60s, they oversaw a lot of the small-scale production of coal on the Navajo Nation. This was just a small activity to give some Navajos employment. It wasn't seen as a big way to transition Navajos from pastoral activities to wage labor. In fact, it didn't even compete with any of the outside reservation mines at that time. O'Neill, to her credit, does a lot of good work on showing how the unions, in fact, the Union of Mine Workers, didn't really appreciate Indian labor at that time, and organized with Hispanic people and white mine workers. But I mean, there's some racial tension going on between Indian miners and non-Indian miners on outside reservation mines, and so the BIA was running these things in order to kind of give these other miners something to do. Thing went off again. But that was all small scale in nature is an important thing. It wasn't until the 1960s that 1950s in fact, I'm wrong, I put this slide together so it's my fault, but 1950s the Navajo Nation was started contracting with transnational corporations. I put 1960 because that's when Peabody Coal contracted with had its formal contract in 1967 had its first formal contract with the Navajo Nation. But there was other activity going on at this time. It's important to note that the tribal government, the Navajo Nation tribal government, was largely and has always been dependent on revenues from mineral extraction. It was in the interest of the Navajo tribal government to expand mineral extraction on reservation land. And so the 1960s, 1950s, it was an uncontested thing. This is what the tribal government wanted to do. It saw itself as a political entity, like a nation state, and wanted to increase its revenue and wane from what it perceived as a dependency on the federal government and federal monies. And so this was a mentality that supported continued coal expansion, uranium, natural gas, and everything else. And this is it relates back to what we were talking about with Joe Shirley at the beginning of the presentation. 1975, chairman of the Navajo government at this time, Chairman Peter McDonald, helped to establish CERT. It's the Council of Energy Resource Tribes. And as David Wilkins writes, it was meant to be an OPEC for Indian tribes. It was meant to be a way to consolidate the resources and not consolidate it for sale, but the power, the political power, the political weight was thought that the political weight of the tribes would increase if they got together and formed this organization rather than dealing with transnational corporations, the BIA, and the federal government one by one. And so this along with what I already earlier mentioned about this nation-to-nation or type of change in federal policy, this was kind of reflected the sentiment of the 1970s between Indian reservations and the federal government. It's been argued that CERT was pretty quickly co-opted by mineral interests during the Reagan era, which I wouldn't disagree with, given their activities today. But its initial at its initial founding, it was thought to be something to leverage for increased tribal and tribal sovereignty. In fact, let me just take a brief moment to read CMAT Snip's interpretation of the establishment of CERT. He says that the American Indian tribal leaders, from taking lessons from conferences, 22 tribes at this time in 1975 formed the Council of Energy Resource Tribe. CERT was organized as a means for improving Indian control over reservation energy projects. Between 1975 and 1977, CERT was virtually unknown among non-Indians. But in June 1977, CERT opened discussions with leaders from OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. And these meetings raised the possibility of having OPEC involved with tribal energy projects. Amid the energy shortages allegedly caused by OPEC during the 1970s, so the political boundaries were intolerable to the federal government, and they quickly stomped that out and co-opted CERT. So at a time when the Indian reservations were trying to assert more nationalism and sovereignty, as they start to threaten energy reserves for the U.S., these projects are quickly quelled. or stopped out. So 1980. So moving along in the chronology, in 1987, Chairman McDonald and it was still Chairman McDonald and Count and the Navajo Nation Council amend the original leases with Peabody Western Coal Company to in the interest of the Navajo tribe to gain improved royalties for every ton of coal that's sold and that's extracted and sold. This is according to Lorraine Ruffin, who's done a lot of work on this issue. So not to bore you with all these PowerPoint graphs, I'm gonna give you some pictures to give you kind of an idea of what the area looks like. This is not my picture. This is a picture I got off the internet from I believe it is Black Mesa Water Coalition. Somebody from that organization took this picture. But anyway, it's one of the I think there's Black Mesa Mine in Arizona on the Navajo Reservation. This is what it looks like at the actual site of the mine, and you can see two Indian people standing there looking on. This is a picture I took over in over the summer near Kayenta Mine, which is one of the larger producers of coal, the largest producer of coal in the state of Arizona, and ranked number, I think it was 19 on that list that I showed earlier. Some industrial equipment, I don't know what it was for, it was just kind of sitting out there. I put that in the foreground. But in the background, you can see some of the mine activities. I couldn't get any closer, you know. Peabody wouldn't let me get any closer. But there's some of the mine activities out in the background of this picture. And so this is not too far from Kayenta, Arizona, between Kayenta and Shanto, Arizona, if you have any idea of the geography of the Navajo Nation. If you know where Monument Valley is, it's a popular place where people go. It's not too far from that, in fact. And here's another picture of, I tried to zoom in, you know, I don't have an expensive camera, so the pixelation is really bad, but in this area, you can see this is where some of the mining activity has taken place. And this is on Black Mesa, it's kind of a large plateau that jets up from the surrounding landscape for a big part of both the Navajo and Hopi Reservation. And here's another picture of leaving the mine, Kayenta Mine. Safety is an attitude, so I had to drive the speed limit and not cause any problems. But you know, these are kind of the signs that you get before you're approaching the mine, and then you have to go up to the mine gate, and there's a guard and things like that, and they won't let you in. But there's, you know, roads and traffic that allow you to drive up in that and hang out. First, let me read Ruffin I just mentioned earlier. She wrote some interesting stuff on Navajo coal, and then I'll explain some of these statistics. Okay, so in order to support this colonial hypothesis, we have to show that there's a underselling and underdevelopment using dependency, Andre Gunderfrank and these folks' characterization of what's going on with mineral extraction on the Navajo Nation and probably other reservations as well. Ruffin writes that while the Navajo Nation was not originally created as a resource colony, in the late 20th century, it supplies the urban industrial centers of the United States with raw materials. Most of the value of these resources is expropriated by large vertically integrated corporations, not only because of their monopoly power, but also because Department of Interior policies have favored corporate intrusion over Navajo use and development. What Ruffin is talking about is the fact that the coal, once it's produced and And mine, it doesn't go that far before it's burned in power plants that are surrounding the Navajo Reservation. So there's an environmental justice component to this, which I don't really touch on in this presentation, but it's really important. Anyway, the colonialization expropriation thing that Ruffin is mentioning refers to this process, in fact. Once the coal is produced and burned in these power plants, these coal-burning power plants, the energy then supplies cities like Phoenix, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, not necessarily Albuquerque, I don't think, but those cities south and west of the Navajo Reservation. So this is a crux of the colonial relationship now as it exists with. Then with energy needs of large southwestern and western cities, and these energy needs met by extracting mineral wealth or extracting minerals from reservations and selling them or buying them from buying them cheaply from Indian people. And causing all sorts of environmental problems for them in the process. So underselling Navajo coal. Now this doesn't even talk about the environmental problems, but with the selling of coal on the Navajo Nation, since 1967, Peabody has purchased coal at a rate of 37.5 cents per ton. Between 1967 and 1987, Peabody sold coal at 37.5 cents per ton. These arrangements were negotiated at a time when tribal leaders were often hoodwinked into working with these transnational corporations in selling the coal. And so this is a really low price for really good grade coal for the Navajo people. And McDonald realized this in the 70s, and this was the reason why he created CERT, part of the reason why he created CERT. But the important thing to know is that in 1987, McDonald, who was chairman at this time, wanted to renegotiate these leases and move toward a percentage system from this fixed rate of 37.5 cents a coal. He and other tribal leaders asserted that there should be about 12% for each ton of coal sold of the gross proceeds, which is how coal that was mined off federal land at that time in 1987, that was the going rate, 12%. So while the Peabody was buying coal at 37.5 cents a ton, which was about 2% of its gross proceeds, even the federal government on federal lands was selling coal at a higher price. And as you know, the federal government always bends over backwards for corporations, and so they're not selling at the highest price possible. So even the fact that Indian reservations are selling below what the federal government charges transnational corporations says a lot about the relationship between American Indian people and government and transnational corporations. So the Navajo Nation approached the BIA area director at this time. His name was Donald Dodge, and he agreed that this was outrageous and decided to raise the rate to 20%. Of the gross proceeds per ton, but Peabody appealed and lobbied Interior Secretary under Reagan. I think his name was Dodge Hodel, not Dodge Hodel. Hodel was his last name, but I forget what his first name was. Anyway, he agreed with Peabody and didn't raise the minimum rate to 20%. In fact, lowered it down to 12% to the federal minimum. And the Navajo Nation subsequently sued, saying that he wasn't exercising his fiduciary responsibility as having a trustee of Navajo minerals to sell it at the best price that it could fetch. And in fact, he was doing the reverse. He was working with Peabody to sell it at a cheaper price. Ultimately, the Supreme Court, on the numerous occasions and under different arguments, rejected all the claims of the Navajo Nation. The most recent, earlier this year, the Supreme Court again dismissed the Navajo complaints about this. So you know, there's no end to our struggles in this when we're battling the exploitation of our land and our resources. I'm eventually going to get to a conclusion. Sorry, how much time do I have left?
We have room for another half hour.
Okay, I'll be done before then. Sorry for taking so long. So today's situation, 50% of the Navajo Nation budget comes from approximately, this is not an exact figure, but approximately 50% of the Navajo Nation reserve revenues come from royalties from extractive industries, primarily oil, natural gas, and coal. Uranium was banned by Peterson's Law in the 1980s, and it was officially banned and signed into a ban against uranium was signed into law in 2005 by President Joe Shirley, who we saw at the beginning of the presentation. But anyway, so tribal governments continue to pursue large extractive industry projects. Not only the Navajo Nation, but the Hopi tribe, you know, is more complicit with Peabody than others, and Crow Nation, as I mentioned before. I don't know the details that well, but they have a lot of coal that they're sitting on, and they're more willing to exploit it because all of this coal exists on parts of the reservation that's not, as they see it, religiously significant for them. So it's easier for them to extract, where a lot of the coal that exists on Navajo Nation is in areas that have more traditional significance. Black Mesa is really important for Navajo people. Anyway, so getting back to this year, and to the beginning of the presentation, then in 2009, though, the Navajo legislative body supported green jobs, while the Navajo Nation president shunned environmental groups, and recently, there's a lot of background information, but I'll try to summarize it. Navajo Nation president agreed with the Hopi tribe, who just as of September 30th and 29th and 30th made it kicked out environmental activists and environmental groups from their reservation. He said, well, you know, the Navajo people have the same problem, and in fact, you know, the greatest threat to our sovereignty, i.e. the greatest threat to tribal development along these lines, are these environmental organizations. So that's another dimension that I just introduced, and I'm going to try to go over now, quickly, without reading any more of these things, what is going on with the environmental groups, and why are they opposed to these forms of development. So let's get a quick history of the environmental organizations on the Navajo Nation, and show how. And the point is to show that there is now contention since the 1970s. I'll just give you my conclusion before going into it, that there is now contention as to what kind of development is going to happen on a reservation land, and how tribal governments are going to interact with the federal government, and how tribal governments are going to hopefully wane from continued processes of colonialism. There are new grassroots organizations who are opposing this type of resource development that I just outlined. So that's kind of the conclusion coming before I tell you what's going on. So now you have a better understanding of what's happening. In 1987, this is the first instance that I know of from reading people's reports and talking with people of, in fact, an environmental or a non-governmental organization that's concerned about environmental issues opposing a development project on the Navajo Nation. This was by an organization called Dene Care. The acronym stands for Citizens Against Ruining Our Environment, who formed in 1987 and opposed a waste manufacturing plant near Deal Con, Arizona. Since that time, they were Dene Care was instrumental in starting what's now called the Indigenous Environmental Network, which meets regularly and is opposed to a lot of different projects happening on indigenous lands, not necessarily reservation boundaries, but you know, in Canada, they're opposed to the tar sands and other things going on there. So they have a strong presence in environmental activism. 1991, Dene Care opposed continued logging near Navajo, New Mexico. At this time, there was a tribal organization that was working on cutting down trees and selling lumber, and on the Chuska Mountains near where I was working last year, south of where I was working though, between Salley and Winter Rock, Arizona. But anyway, the NACARE organization got together, opposed this log mining, and helped to shut it down. If you read, it's funny though when you reflect on this. I mean, these are all just dates and statements, but you know, I go through the archives sometimes of the area paper, the Navajo Times, and when I was looking through the archives this last summer, I came across an article that from the 1960s. I forget what year. And the article was talking about the development of Navajo, New Mexico. It's a town. It's actually called a town. It's on the reservation, but it's called Navajo, New Mexico. And how tribal leaders at this time were trying to use it as a place to start this lumber industry, and there's going to be all these jobs, and there's going to be a solution for all the economic woes that were affecting Navajo people, and you know, but then you see the end result of it, and it's just been nothing but environmental destruction and no jobs and decrepit infrastructure. You drive by their sawmills today, and they're just these big, large, open warehouses that are spray painted with graffiti and are closed off and sit there and don't do anything. And that's what happens when you, that's a consequence of basing economic development on resource extraction. In that respect, so that's an interesting side note on the logging near in Navajo, New Mexico. In 2005, another environmental organization called ENDOM, the acronym stands for Eastern Navajo Dene Against Uranium Mining. The Navajo and Dene are redundant. Navajo and Dene are the same thing, but so it's always funny to say it. But this organization. It was founded a long time before. This organization has been working it does a disservice to the work of ENDOM by saying that they only came to this act in 2005, because they've been working on it for quite a while to officially ban uranium mining. But in 2005, they came together with the Navajo president, Joe Shirley, again at this time, and another organization based in Albuquerque, New Mexico, called the Southwest Research Institute, I think, and put together legislation to put in the Navajo Nation tribal code an act called the Dene Natural Resources Protection Act of 2005, which evokes something called the Fundamental Laws of the Dene. Another background story that I'm not going to go into, but evoked traditional law to say that harming the environment is wrong and bad, and uranium mining should be ceased on Navajo Nation, or should be banned forever from Navajo Nation. It's also important, but it's important to realize that at this time in 2005, uranium banning had ceased to exist for about 25 years. On the Navajo Nation. And between 1999 and 2006, BMWBC, along with other small organizations like Tolton Ejone Ane, and forget the others, but the Black Mesa Water Coalition and the other organization opposed the coal mining on Black Mesa. I don't know if any of you have a, this is a pretty well-known story, what happened in between 1999 and 2006. 2003, I think, is when most of this activity was going on with BMWC and the Tribal Council. But essentially, coal resources that were extracted from this mine in Black Mesa were being slurried to Laughlin, Nevada, 273 miles away, using pristine aquifer water in order to get the coal and ship it out to this power plant to burn it and sell it to California. You know, and people near Black Mesa are dependent on water. It's an arid environment, and there's not a lot of water, and to use pristine aquifer water for coal slurry was seen as a horrible thing. And that was the argument Black Mesa took before the council. Ultimately, the power plant shut down because it was too dirty for California to buy from this power plant anymore. And so January 1st, 2006, it shut down, and Black Mesa Mine has been closed since. And the most recent activity by environmental organizations has been by this organization called Dodd Desert Rock, which also works with Dene Care and all these other organizations. And it's not to say that they all are segregated from one another, but they all coalesce in certain respects. To oppose a power plant called the Desert Rock Power Plant in the northeastern part of the reservation. And this is, you know, a consequence of having a lot of coal is that you have a lot of power plants. A lot of incentive to burn coal near the area. It's been said that this part of the reservation near Shiprock and Farmington has the air quality level that's the same as Los Angeles, because there's already two power plants in that area, the Navajo Generating Station and San Juan Power Plant. So this would have been the third coal-burning power plant to be constructed in the area. Okay, so to take you out of the boredom of what I'm saying, I'm going to give you some more pictures. This is some of the organizations I just mentioned as they're opposing the Desert Rock project. We have Louise Brown sitting there with a sign that reads, "Site Global, please don't kill our children." She's a prime organizer with Dodd Desert Rock. You can see the banner for Indigenous Environmental Network, which has a history with the Dene Care and the International Treaty Council over in the right-hand corner. I think this protest was done in Denver last year, but I'm not sure. But anyway, this kind of gives you an idea of the activities of these environmental organizations. Here's one of the flyers that they put out. The organizations, when they get together, they sometimes put out these flyers that address all of the issues going on. Defend Our Homeland is, you know, you can read that. There's a power plant in the background. It's direct reference to the construction of the Desert Rock power plant. But also they talk about Peabody Coal, which is the owner of the coal in Cantum and Black Mesa Mine. So they're talking about, I mean, this flyer is talking about three different activities going on. There's a snowball campaign, which is an effort to not use effluent wastewater on what's called the San Francisco Peaks outside of Flagstaff, Arizona, for skiing, but that's off reservation land, so I'm not talking about that necessarily. No doubt there's a rock, which I mentioned is mentioned here, and the Peabody thing is mentioned here too, and those are two separate things to be clear. So you can see how these things are brought together. I'm almost done, so bear with me. I'm going to read now a little bit from, you know, as I was finishing up this PowerPoint, trying to think of what can you say. I mean, this is a situation, and what's the future of Navajo development or the trajectory of the Navajo tribe as it includes its people and its government, which, you know, often have conflicting interests. So Lorraine Ruffin wrote in, whose work I used to talk about the coal, she wrote in this book in 1979 that federal interference and monopoly power have caused massive transfers of value and underdevelopment of the Navajo economy. The economic subordination of the Navajo economy reveals itself in the dominance of expert activities and the lack of internal integration and the neglect of the traditional sector and the growing income inequalities. Transnational corporations and estates, like the turn of the century traders, expropriate through low royalties or taxes most of the value of the Navajo resources. Mineral activities are well developed by energy companies to supply urban industrial centers, while 50% of the Navajo homes are without electricity. This was in 1979. That's the figures changed a little. Timber products are marketed in 25 states. Yet there is a Navajo housing deficit of 13,000 units. Development plans for commercial agriculture call for the raising of profitable export crops, despite the fact that Navajo lives are shortened by 25 years due to poor diet. Her solution is the reversal of the master transfer of value, and the development of the Navajo economy demand both a well-articulated development strategy and certain structural changes. She eventually says that the Navajo tribe should invest in the traditional sector, which was sheep at that time, and to try to give people jobs by doing things that they've done traditionally. They can build cooperatives, sell wool through cooperative mechanisms, and they can also, like she was talking about, goat cheese and things like that. And so to think about small scale economic development, emphasizing the traditional sector to both address this need for jobs and economic development, and also to preserve culture and tradition. This is not too dissimilar from what the Green Jobs Campaign has been said 20 years, 30 years later, in fact, 70s, 30 years ago, that's a long time. But anyway, so, 1979, this is Lorraine Ruffin's talking about reinvesting in the traditional sector. 2009, the Navajo Green Jobs Coalition is saying the same thing, just using different terms and then with different words. And so this brings us to our conclusion. Resource extraction on the Navajo Nation, I hope that I gave you this impression, it creates internal conflicts, socially speaking, between these environmental organizations and tribal government officials, as was demonstrated by Joe Shirley's quote. Tribal governments are largely dependent on the revenues from extractive industries still today. That situation hasn't changed since the 60s and 70s. But now we have new issues. We have climate change and global warming, and the societies, reservation societies are different in nature than they were in the 70s. So these are the questions that we're left with. What are the environmental costs of continued coal extraction, oil extraction, gas extraction? What are the social costs of continuing this type of development? There's that division between the government and the people over the issue of sovereignty and development is a good example of this. And how does this relate to continued processes of colonialism? Those are my closing thoughts on the issue. There's one more thing I was going to say, but I think now that we've gone through the whole thing and I've kind of laid out the problem, it would be good to return back to Nikki Alex's quote from before as to why she is pursuing green jobs development. And this is the one I read earlier, but now that we've gone through a lot of the background information, it might make more sense. And this is a future that young people, some young people have on the reservation of what they want. We want green jobs for the Navajo youth. Right now, unemployment on the reservation is at 44%. There's nothing for young people. The only ones working are college graduates. There are no jobs. That's why I'm pushing for Green Jobs Act, because of these reasons. These jobs aren't coal mining, and B, they're safe for Mother Earth. I'm pushing for this more job creation and development. And so that's the end. Thank you.
So thank you first to all our speakers for very informative and thought-provoking discussions. And then also thank you to all of you for coming out. If you're more interested in more of our events, organizations coming up, we have a website, a Facebook group, the Native American Student Association of Binghamton. And feel free to come up and ask any questions to Paulette, myself, and I won't speak for the other speakers, but I think in case they have somewhere to go, but we're going to be hanging around cleaning up. And so thank you again.
Thanks for coming.